Vegas, baby, Vegas!
At the end of the game, you count up your money. That's how you find out who's best.
If all my bets were safe, there just wouldn't be any juice.
The point spreads, the prop bets, the teasers, the parlays. From Vegas to you, this is Behind the Bets.
Welcome back to another episode of Behind the Bets with Doug Kazarian, presented by DraftKings, America's top-rated sportsbook app. Busy time of year. We suffered for a long time, and now we got sports up and running. And the weather not exactly cooperating. So Mother Nature wreaking havoc here in Connecticut and other parts of the U.S., obviously. So I had power outages. Christina, you had a power outage as well.
I did. I don't have any power in my apartment, but I have Wi-Fi.
We were making things work, smoke and mirrors. And normally it wouldn't be that big of a deal for work because we would just go into Bristol and go to campus and get our work done. But we can't really do that. It's a selective appearances at the ESPN campus. So we had to delay the pod to this morning. And obviously with a golf major, we apologize to those who are waiting, so we appreciate everyone's patience. So Wes Reynolds coming up. Matthew Holt, he's graduated. He's gone. He's too cool for school. Just kidding. No, he's just really jammed yesterday and today. And I've been thinking about bringing in Lou Finocchiaro for a while. You know him on other platforms. Does a great job with the MMA, so it's just perfect timing. Matthew Holt didn't love this card anyway, so he and Lou know each other. And so Lou will be joining us for UFC picks at the end of the pod. But we're going to have Wes coming up. And momentarily, but first, got to talk about the crazy stuff going on with the bubble. How about the Milwaukee Bucks? 19-point favorites, consensus favorites against the Brooklyn Nets and what's left of them. But, hey, TLC goes off. Some other guys go off. And the Nets stun the Bucks. No Giannis second half, but still 19-point favorites. In terms of the point spread, the largest upset in NBA since 1993 in our database. So incredible. Obviously, the bubble life and the neutral court, it's wild. But certainly noteworthy stuff, but let's get to the golf and the UFC straight ahead. But before we do that, I want to remind everyone with the much anticipated start of the 2020 football season just around the corner, make sure you're staying up to date on all your fantasy football news with ESPN fantasy experts Matthew Berry, Field Yates, Stefania Bell, Mike Clay, and Daniel Dopp on the Fantasy Focus Football Podcast. You'll get daily strategy previews and injury reports to ensure you have all the information you'll need for your fantasy football team. Be sure to download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football and Behind the Bets on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Stop. Hammer time.
All right, time now to bring in Wes Reynolds, a newfound friend of the program. Wes, it's the first major of the year. It's not something you usually say in August, but obviously 2020 a little different than other years. But first things first, I want to talk Tiger Woods because he obviously, you know, the joke is he doesn't move the needle. He is the needle. And I'm just not feeling him this weekend. I think with the weather being what it is, I think that usually kind of initiates some back issues. And I just think he kind of plays the long game with the maybe that's not the right word, but he's focused on the Masters usually at this age. I mean, it is a major, so he's not going to be completely dismissive, but I think there's value fading him in some of these matchups.
Yeah, Doug, yeah, I agree. And I was talking to our mutual friend, Jeff Sherman, who is one of the main odds makers over at Westgate Superbook USA right here in Las Vegas. And he was against him in a bunch of matchups this week. And I couldn't really disagree with him just simply because you mentioned the weather, which is another factor, but it's just that he doesn't have hardly any reps. He has basically four rounds at Muirfield Village for the Memorial where he made the cut on the number, and he hasn't really played since then. And we've been talking about this on our VSiN show launch us over the last several weeks because we always have a Tiger Tracker segment week in and week out. And I've been liking him. You mentioned the Masters. I've been taking a little bit of a fancy to him, perhaps for the U.S. Open at Wingfoot in mid-September, just because I believe that he's at least probably going to have some reps going in, not just this week at the PGA, but after next week at the Wyndham Championship, then you get right into the FedEx Cup events. And he is well within the points for the FedEx Cup, so he's going to be playing those events and then maybe has to work his way into the top 30 to get into the Tour Championship. But he can have 2 to 3 tournaments before he plays the U.S. Open. So that's why I would like him a little bit better there. And then, of course, the Masters is always his best of the usual four majors where he's going to be able to win and compete, since he just won it as recently as last April. So, yeah, I'm not really high on him this week. He's in an early group starting Thursday. He's in that threesome with Rory McIlroy and Justin Thomas. So that's a high-powered trio there, and they are in the morning. So they will get the likely easier conditions in the morning. When you talk about the draw bias, because we know that the wind is expected to be pretty consistent throughout the entire week and weekend, but Thursday morning is where the conditions are going to be a little bit easier. So I would say, look, I never want to necessarily go against him to miss the cut, because he's such a grinder. He's the greatest grinder the game has ever seen, besides the fact of his superior talent. So I think he finds a way to make the cut, kind of like he did at the Memorial. But yeah, I'm not really high on him, his chances this week either.
He's a dog in most of his matchups. Webb Simpson, Cantlay, Morikawa, Schauffele, sizable favorite over him, minus 210, some offshore places. So you don't see that very often. He is a slight favorite to Louis Oosthuizen, which is interesting because, and Wes, this was kind of predates you, but I've given out picks from, I have a quote-unquote guy in Vegas, so I only get his picks from his really sharp golf friend. But it just kind of adds to the mystery of the whole handicapping world. But he picks at least one winner for a major every year, and he was on Gary Woodland. I think it was 100-1 that year. So the picks finally came in, and I'll just read them off to you, and let me know if you're gonna you want to feel like talk about. But Koepka, Schwartzel, Lowry, Oosthuizen, Danny Willett, and Schwartzel's his top pick, but he also likes Siwoo Kim as a flyer at 300-1. He got a couple weeks.
Well, ago. I am on a couple of those, Doug, and it's the two guys from the UK, that being Shane Lowry and Danny Willett, who I have both well over triple digits. The wind, I think, look, that's a factor that makes me like them a little bit more, because these are guys that are proven players in right. those type of conditions and have won tournaments. I'll start with Lowry first. Look, he hasn't had a top 10 finish or top 5 or top 10 finish on either the PGA or the European tours. He had a second at the Hong Kong Open, but that was a January event with a little bit of a weaker field on the Asian tour. But he hasn't been in the top 10 since that triumph at Royal Portrush for the Open last summer, but he comes in with some momentum. He was tied for 6th at Memphis last weekend. And one thing that he got back, maybe he got his groove back or his confidence back, Bo Martin is his regular caddy, and he had been off for a little while on a paternity leave. So he was back on the bag last week. And last week, you look at some of the numbers and the stats for Shane Lowry: 2nd in strokes gained around the green, 2nd in scrambling, 6th in strokes gained tee to green, 7th in greens in regulation, 13th in total driving, 14th in driving distance. And we know this course this week, you got to be able to bomb and gouge a little bit. So he should be able to do that. He was also 2nd with his irons from approach, strokes gained approach, last Sunday's final round. So you're getting a guy at triple digits that, look, he's the number 26 player in the world in the official world golf ranking, and he's one of only 4 guys, being Brooks Koepka, Tiger Woods, and Gary Woodland, that's got a current major trophy in his trophy case and on his mantle right now. So Lowry certainly fits. Danny Willett, he was somebody I bet after the Memorial, and you'll recall he was 4th after 3 rounds and then had a terrible Sunday round, shot 82 and ended up finishing 32nd, but those conditions and those pin placements were just awful and beat all of those guys up, including the eventual winner, John Rahm. And look, he came in with a good finish. He was 4th at the Rocket Mortgage Classic in Detroit just a couple weeks before. He's also got success on this course. If you go back to the last kind of big tournament that was played here, that was the 2015 WGC Cadillac Match Play. And Willett in that event defeated Patrick Reed, Lee Westwood, Tommy Fleetwood, some pretty good players in match play competition before he lost to Gary Woodland in the semifinals, and then Willett came back and beat Jim Furyk in the third place match. He was then number five in the world to finish overall third place. So, yeah, Donnie Willett is a guy that I think, and he kind of is a big game hunter. He shows up when you least expect it at really big events, as evident by his green jacket win a few years ago.
No, so you're saying the weather's going to kind of cultivate some links-style golf, is I guess what you're trying to hint at. So you
a little bit, yeah. Okay. We're seeing projections of maybe 20-plus mile-an-hour winds at some points over the weekend. Maybe not so much on Thursday, but it's at least going to get into the teens in terms of the wind gust. And one of the things about this, just reading and listening to some guys that have seen the course already, the rough is about 4 inches thick, and I know Bryson DeChambeau, who I've got an anti-post bet on. I took him several weeks ago at a much better number. He's not necessarily a pick for the week, but I got a ticket on him. He was, of course, being Bryson and saying, oh, it should be no problem and whatnot. He's kind of got that cocky, confident edge about him, which he would rather have rather than being negative. But look, I think this rough is going to be punitive if you don't hit fairways. And yeah, it's not going to be totally like a U.S. Open, but I think it's going to be harder than what you would see with the normal PGA, considering Brooks Koepka shot 264, which is the all-time scoring record in the PGA just 2 years ago.
No, it's a great point. And my like top guy, if you will, in terms of like the best players and the lowest odds is I'm going with John Rahm. I mean, right now, 16-1 at Caesars. And I think, look, he's as good as they come when he's in his peak form. I know you had him a couple of weeks ago and stuck the landing there. The odds are a little off because of last week. And I remember when you picked him, he had shot the previous Sunday a really low score. And I believe it was the same course the next week, but he did that last week. I think his ceiling, I mean, he's going to lose that label of the best player to not win a major. And it's par 70, 7,200. I think he has enough length. I just think the recent form kind of 2 weeks ago with the win, I just have to grab 16-1.
Yeah, I can't argue with it. And he's one of those guys I'm still debating maybe a late add-on because I think he will like the conditions because, look, he's won all over the world. He's won in Europe, so he's comfortable playing in those type of conditions. I know Sunday when he won at the Memorial, when the conditions got a little bit tougher and where the pins were placed, you know, he leaked a little bit of oil toward the end, but by and large, he was very much in control of that tournament. And yeah, I think he would definitely like these conditions. He has the game. He was actually my pick, and I'm still kind of sticking with him. He was my pick at the beginning of the year to win the Masters because you recall he was in contention last year. A lot of guys were in contention before Tiger got real hot on the back nine and ended up getting another green jacket put in his closet. But Rahm is ready to win a major. And I know some people have said, oh, he's a money pit in majors. Well, he's only 25 years old, keep in mind. So
I mean, he looks 45.
Yeah, I know. I know, but he's got
I say that lovingly, but yeah, he does not look 25.
Yeah, he's got his whole career ahead of him. I've always said it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, and it's a matter of how many, because this guy is going to be a multiple-time major champion. I have no doubt about that.
Yeah, once you get over the hump, we've seen it. Obviously, Mickelson comes to mind, then sort of like the dam is broken. And it happened with like LeBron and other sports. It's sort of just getting that first one. It'll be interesting to see what happens with Mahomes and company at the Chiefs. But back to this tournament. The other one I just have to grab, and this is a great, like, I'm sure like a psychology, like, PhD student can do a thesis on this, but Daniel Berger at 40-1. Look, it's pretty hard to play as well as he's played and be under the radar, right? Top five in five of the last six starts, right? And that includes a win at the Charles Schwab Challenge, but he's still getting 40-1 odds. And I think it's because of just that where he was before, right? And you know, we hear this in live wagering a lot. Like, let's say the Lakers are playing like the Wizards and their Lakers are like -6 and they're up 12-0 and Bradley Beal rolls his ankle and he's out for the rest of the game. And then you're like, all right, the live line's like 8.5. And people would be like, oh, I can't lay 8.5. I could have had 6 earlier. I'm like, yeah, but it's a different game. Like, no Beal, and you have a 10, you know, 12-0 head start. Like, it's, you can't look at it through that lens of what the closing line was. It's just a different game. Now, if you don't like the number, you don't like the bet, that's different. You can't just be stuck on it. So my point is this. With Berger being a long shot previously, and now I think it's just a different assessment. I think you have to kind of assess a hot golfer. I think you have to assess that maybe he's kind of here to stay in terms of this odds range, and maybe even less. So I just feel like you almost have to not be held captive to the fact that you could have gotten triple digits not too long ago.
Right. And you look at the stats in terms of Berger, he's right there in so many of them. He's, I think, 8th on the tour in total driving, in terms of strokes gained tee to green. I think he's 13th. I'm just looking over the numbers here. And then in scrambling, 2nd on tour in scrambling. And you're going to have to do a little bit of that this week because the greens are on the smaller side. The fairways are a little bit more narrow than a typical PGA Tour event. He went well last week. And what you were saying about numbers is so true, because I know some people were on him last week at kind of a little bit of a shorter price than what his market price would normally indicate. And that was likely because he'd won back-to-back years in Memphis a few years prior. So I looked at that and I was like, you know what? Obviously, I can understand why people were picking him, but the number is so small. And maybe that the number keeps you off. And that's what sometimes we have to do betting golf futures, is we have to balance that, what his number should be and what the quality of the player and what the fit is for a given event or a given course. So
right.
You don't want to necessarily get too choosy. That's what kept me in terms of an in-play wager off of Justin Thomas. I could have got him at 18-1 on last Friday night, near double the price. And I didn't end up pulling the trigger, and I regret it. So, you know, sometimes you can't just necessarily just go with numbers. You have to also go with your gut as well, and in terms of the fit it's going to be. And you don't want to get too knee deep in the weeds and say, well, I've got him priced at 50 and he's 40, so I can't play him.
Let me just ask you this, and the listener as well as you. If I told you at the beginning of the year there's a golfer who's tearing things up at these top 5 finish in 5 of 6 tournaments, including a win, you can get him at 40-1. Now, obviously, it's a stacked field given it's a major. Like, I don't care if it's me who did that, right? Like, I think you just kind of have to do it because – and this goes back to things we've talked about a bunch on this podcast in terms of win streaks, right? Like, the Orlando Magic have gone over 15 straight games. It's insane. It's the longest in our database, which is three decades. And with these hot streaks, like Alabama first half a couple of years ago, you can always jump on, and you're only going to be wrong once, right? You're always worried they're going to jump on too. Mm-hmm. You jump on and back it, you're only going to be wrong once. But if you try to bet into it, you can be wrong a lot because the streak can be – who says the Magic are going to stop going over at 15, right? Like, now – would it have been great to jump in at like 7? Of course, but that's not on the table. It's now or the next one. Right. So with Berger, like, we might laugh. He could be, you know, 7 straight tournaments where he's a top 5. Like, he could win the next one. So I think we could laugh, meaning 40 was value, because he could be a guy in that 20-25 range not too long from now. So I have to take a piece of that 40-1.
Yeah, I can't argue with that. And that's a very good point that you make in terms of, trying to go against streaks, because I think, you know, oftentimes, you know, some of the sharper bettors are going to want to go against, because once a trend usually becomes public and widespread public knowledge, then that's almost when you like want to get off. But like you said, and you made a very good point there, you've only got to be wrong once. It's not like you can lose multiple wagers. It's like, okay, if I hop on an overtrend and it loses, well, I lost one bet. I didn't lose 5 or whatever. So I didn't lose 5 necessarily trying to stop the trend. And that's something I've had to learn in my betting of other sports. It's like, you know, do I want to – because bettors by our nature, we're very stubborn people. And we want to be right. It's not just about winning money. We want to be right as well. So it's like, well – it didn't end, the streak didn't end there, so it's got to end here. and you go back to the well so many times, whereas it's like, sometimes it's as simple as just riding it. And if it, and if you get knocked off the horse, okay, go back to something else.
Yeah. And humans is like, just put something on it. If you like it, just get, even if it's a lunch money, right? Just get something on it, so you don't feel like you completely missed out, because that's a great point. We are stubborn, but we also have FOMO, at least the non-math guys. Like, we're all like, the gamblers have FOMO, and like, that's our biggest fear. It's like, ah, I was going to do that. And that sometimes forces us to make a play. It's because you don't want it to win and then miss out. So I think it's like a perfect storm of FOMO and stubbornness. And obviously it's a challenging industry, and you got every little, you know, bet and every little margin matters. So those are my top guys in terms of the somewhat low odds. What about you? What are some other guys that you're going to be backing?
Yeah, I'll go with the lower guys first. And I took them at 25-1 several weeks ago. And look, it's kind of like that old famous 70s song by Cornelius Brothers and Sister Rose, "It's Too Late to Turn Back Now." So I'm going to stick with Xander Schauffele, even though he has been a very popular pick this week and got.
Oh, yeah, he's the chic pick. That's the chic pick right now.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know myself and our buddy Matt Humans are both on him. And Matt likes Xander pretty much every week. That's one of his favorite guys to play. But look, it worries me that it's a little bit trendy, but I'm sticking with it because I just think he fits the profile. He's going back to California, even though he's a SoCal kid from San Diego and not a Northern California guy. But I think he's going to be comfortable going back. 5 top 6 finishes the last 3 years in majors. He's got a top 3 in every major, with the exception of the PGA. That's been his weakest of the 4 majors. And look, I liked him last week. He didn't come through in Memphis, but ended up a respectable tie for 6. Had a couple bogey 3 rounds on Thursday and Sunday. I believe he took an 8 on a hole on Friday, which really took him out of the tournament. But he still only finished 4 back of Thomas. But what was most impressive to me, Doug, in terms of looking at his numbers, there were 78 players in the field last week at Memphis, and he was 74th out of 78 in the field for strokes gained approach. The average, I believe, was minus 1.39 strokes per round. So that's over 5.5 shots for a tournament that you're losing with your irons. And he's a better iron player than he showed last week. His strength is obviously off the tee. That's where really his bread and butter is, and then kind of scrambling a little bit. But that could have made the difference maybe in the win and really being in contention if his irons were a little bit better. But look, top 10 in strokes gained off the tee, top 10 in strokes gained tee to green, top 10 in greens and regulation, top 10 in total driving, led the field last week in Memphis in strokes gained around the green. So that tells you that he's escaping a little bit of trouble, that this is a guy, okay, I missed the green. And we know when we watch tournaments and we see those guys on the hole and a ball hits the green and rolls off or something, so now you got a chip and try to be able to save par, you catch a tough break. And Xander Schauffele is one of those guys that's really able to recover from those. So Schauffele is one guy, and then I added another Southern California guy that I think will like going back to the Golden State, and that's Patrick Cantlay, who is not in as great a form. He was only 35th last week in Memphis, but and usually that would disqualify him from consideration, because I think every PGA Tour winner, like going back to 06, I think had finished in the top 30 or just outside the top 25 for the week before. But you look at what Cantlay did over the weekend last time out in Memphis. He was 8 under, 4th best in the field. And like I said, when we talked about Rahm at the Memorial, where we were looking at a little subtle buy sign in terms of what he did at the workday, where he finished 27th, but he shot 64 on Sunday, carried it over the next week, and Cantlay maybe could do the same here. And he's got the game for the majors. He was tied for 3rd at Bethpage last year for the PGA, ended up tied for 9th at the Masters, actually held the outright lead when I believe he had an eagle late on the back 9 on Sunday at the Masters. And then, look, guy had never been there before in the majors. So next tee shot, he puts it in the trees and takes a double, and that took him out of contention for the tournament. But fourth in strokes gained approach, seventh in strokes gained tee to green. And I think he'll like this. So those are two guys. A couple guys I did play that I already had bets on. I did play Montsioma at 40-1. It's a broken record. The ball striking is elite. The putting is absolutely dreadful. But I think he could like it this week because he's a very good player in the wind. Last time, remember, when you had a field this big that was a major championship-esque field was the Players Championship, which got canceled after round one due to the pandemic. But he was first-round leader there, shooting 9-under-63. So, you know, I mean, it just came at the wrong time because he was coming in with some confidence. Went to the round of 16 here on this course at the match play that I mentioned earlier back in 2015. But unfortunately ran into Rory McIlroy, who was number one in the world and the number one seed in the event and won said event. So Matsuyama is a guy that could fit. And then also let me give a nod as well to Jason Day. And I mentioned this watching the Memphis coverage last Sunday, and I tweeted it out. I go, Jason Day looks like he's found something. It's been a lean couple years. He hasn't had a top three or better finish since he won the Wells Fargo back in May of 2018. And look, he's had a lot of injuries. I mean, the poor guy is a great guy, but he's made of glass. He's always injured. And then plus he was dealing with swing changes and dropped down below the top 60 in the rankings. But now three top seven finishes at the Workday, the Memorial, and then at Memphis. Split about a month and a half, 2 months ago with his longtime swing coach, Colin Swatton, and he's kind of getting a little bit back to basics. And the short game is still there. He's still got one of the best short games in professional golf. But he rated top 10 last week in strokes gained approach. And the iron play is usually, if you want to call it a weakness, is really the weakness of his game. But he's a guy that I'm going to like in the wind. And plus, there's a West Coast correlation. He's won twice at Torrey Pines. He's always a contender at Pebble Beach. And he could be able to roll the ball really well this week. He likes that bent grass POA on with green complex, which you're going to get here at Harding Park this week. So Jason Day, I think he's been cut down to about 40. I would like to see if there were some 50s out there. That's around where I got him. But I'll give a nod to him if you're looking for a middle price guy.
We're always looking for that. I got one long shot. I'm always good for one triple digit. And I mentioned him earlier, but I am going to go with Siwoo Kim. You know, he's kind of like, he kind of has a knack for doing one or two great rounds per tournament. Obviously he has trouble closing, but he does have two career wins, including the Players Championship a few years ago. His recent stats, some of them back it up. He ranks 37th in strokes gained around the green. Now look, he's 200-1. He was 300-1 not too long ago. There's a reason for that, but I'm going to take a flyer because I like me some triple digits every tournament.
Yeah, absolutely. You got to, somebody that's in that price range is always going to get on the leaderboard at a major. I mean, it's not just going to be chalk, chalk, chalk on that first page. It may be mostly chalk, but not all chalk. So, yeah, I mentioned my triple digits with Lowry and Danny Willett, and then I played another guy, not quite triple digits, at 85-1, Sergio Garcia. Look, windy conditions. Got to be good off the tee, and he's still one of the best drivers of the golf ball in the world, even at 40 years old. So third in strokes gained off the tee, third in strokes gained tee to green, was actually second in the field last week in Memphis off the tee, but we know what happens. The putter holds him back. But you don't have to be a really good putter to win majors. You just have to putt good that week is something that I always say. I think the wind is going to be kind of an equalizer for some of these guys. So you may see this play a little bit more like an open championship. We didn't think we were going to get an open championship this year, but we may get one with some of this wind happening. So that's what opens it up for the Garcias and the Danny Willetts and the Shane Lowrys and those type of guys. So, I know everybody's going to focus on the top of the board with Brooks Koepka and Justin Thomas, and rightfully so, considering they have the last three Wanamaker trophies for this event. But don't be afraid with maybe some of these international players. And your friend that you mentioned earlier, Louis Oosthuizen, he hasn't been in form in a long time, but he played pretty solid at Memphis last week. And if this is an open championship type of event, he's obviously won an open championship. That's his lone major. So, and he's always very good over there. So look toward those guys, maybe closer to the triple digits or like the 80-1 range.
A lot of good stuff there, Wes. A lot of fun with the major. I like the tie-in with the Lynx Golf and the British Open we will not be having. Although you're particular, I apologize. It's the Open Championship. So my apologies to you purists.
No, our buddy Matt Eumanns always rips me. He's like, it's the British Open, Wes. It's not the Open Championship. But I'm like, hey, they want to call it the Open Championship, so I'm going to go with the Queen's English and do as the Romans do, so to speak.
Yeah, the birthplace of golf, right? Fair enough. Great stuff as always, my man. Sorry about the delay. I appreciate your flexibility on the schedule, and good luck this weekend.
All right, you got it, Doug. Thanks for having me as always, man.
Time now to bring in someone new to the Behind the Bets podcast, Lou Finicaro. You might hear him on other platforms, Lou for UFC Lou and all sorts of nicknames. But Lou, we appreciate your taking the time and joining us.
I really appreciate you having me on, Doug. I look forward to breaking down some fights with you and your listeners.
Yeah, I know. As I said at the top of the podcast, Matthew Holt is busy, but I was planning on bringing you on anyway. So it's not just a, you know, coach calls you when I was reaching out anyway. So hopefully we'll get a lot of wisdom on this pod from a lot of different angles. But look, you're a guy who's been immersed in this. Just give our listeners a little bit about your background and how long you've been following and associated with the UFC, so to speak.
Sure. So, and I will start by saying thank you. For me to even share the pod with Matthew Holt would be an honor, to be honest with you. I have nothing but respect for the guy, and I'm happy to step in with him or in lieu of him any time. I'm a longtime fight, hockey, and NFL handicapper. My first experience with fights was the state-of-the-art technology in 1971 was a clock radio. And in sixth grade, I stayed up on, I want to say it was a March night, and listened to Frazier and Ali 15 rounds, the first fight that they had from Madison Square Garden. And since then, I've been consumed with the fight game and have been betting it since high school. And while in the last 10, 15 years in all my handicapping, I have embraced analytics to utilize in capacity with what I think is one of my best advantages, the fact that I've been doing this for four decades. So I bring a lot of experience, and I'd like to think, you know, some good analytics behind my thought process, at least in the fights and the other two sports that I cover. And I look forward to maybe sharing a few thoughts with you on the fights. I will say my overall fight philosophy, and really my overall betting philosophy, is that I strive to find value with underdogs. And that's not to say that I won't bet a favorite. And in the main event that we'll talk about shortly, there's a favorite that's starting to show some tremendous value. So if the value shows up on a favorite, I'm not afraid, but I'm really trying to diagnose live underdogs.
All right, so talk a little bit about analytics. That's something we haven't dove into that much on this pod, just because, you know, you associate with basketball, and then over the recent years you've seen football and you associated with baseball, but in the last couple of years you've seen football and basketball sort of embrace it. How do you incorporate analytics in a sport like MMA?
What a great question. And one of your ESPN cohorts, Reed Kuhn, who does some writing for ESPN for the UFC as well, he came out with a book in 2013 called Fight Metric. And he was the one that wanted to quantify the fight game into analytics. And I couldn't wait to cut him down and to debate him about what a foolish idea that was, me being a guy that for 30 years had been betting the fights. So I thought that I would at least do him the favor and read his book before I addressed him, because I was coming at him like a fighter out of the corner at the opening bell. However, upon reading his book, I, instead of wanting to criticize him for his idea, became his greatest disciple. And within that book, there's a lot of common sense, but there's also a number of things he breaks down. Brazilians in a Brazilian cage. If the age difference is greater than 4 years, if a stand-up fight and if the reach difference is 2 inches or greater, all of these things, all of those angles provide advantage. For instance, younger man by 4 years in a striking battle, or I should say in any battle, is a 62% angle. And so what I did was embraced his numbers and then found my own analytics guy to update those numbers from 2013, just this year, to 2020. And so the analytics can really complement how I try and project a fight will go.
Yeah, I've always said, you know, I think someone told me, I think on this podcast, was analytics can be like kind of a North Star, like a starting point, a guide, but you can't be all in unless you do it all the time, right? And that's just not, obviously, I'm not in that lane, but I respect it. I try to embrace it. And I try to aggregate that information. So it sounds like you've, you know, you learned your lesson, not even the hard way, the easy way. You did your homework, but you didn't take it on the chin, so to speak, pun intended, with trying to fade some of the analytics, because you respected it and you've tried to just made it better. You've evolved. So I give you a lot of props on that front. So let's get into this card. And, you know, last week was not the most exciting card, but we're beginning an interesting stretch here. You and I had talked off air, and you're intrigued by this main event, just a total contrast in styles.
A complete contrast in styles, talent. And I have to say, oftentimes I have strong opinions on heavyweight fights, but this one is vexing. And I'll start with Derek Lewis, who's 35-year-old man and really is going to – he's a lumbering, rotund man that has a hard time making the 265-pound weight. His fighting style is very easily described. He's a brawler, a striker, a power slugger, and because of his size, you know, he really has 7-8 minutes of explosion and effectiveness before he starts to really get lethargic and telegraphing with his strikes. But his power, if he hits you, you're going out. On the other side of the octagon is a 43-year-old man. You know, Lewis, 35, that's about right for a heavyweight. 43 in the heavyweight, starting to get a little bit ripe. And Alexei Oleinik, Russian fighter who's had some, you know, 60-some fights. Over his career, he has a wealth of experience. He brings in a master of sport in Brazilian jiu-jitsu, in Russian jiu-jitsu, a master of sport in Russian sambo, which is grappling and tripping. He also has a black belt in Brazilian jiu-jitsu. So Oleinik strikes only long enough to try and grab an arm, a leg, get the opponent to the ground where he can submit. And he's a submission specialist. It's really what he wants to do. He's uncomfortable on the feet and very awkward on the feet. Of his 59 career wins, 46 by submission for Oleinik. So Oleinik, who in his last fight against Fabricio Werdum on May 9th, when the UFC cranked up again, he looked wonderful against Werdum in a victory, yeah, but he weighed 228 pounds, and he's going to enter the octagon at 230 or so. Lewis will be 270 or more. And so Oleinik's going to be giving away a massive amount of size and girth. And so the cat and mouse here is, can Lewis stalk Oleinik down and touch him? Oleinik, he has one weakness, and that is he can be knocked out, and he's been knocked out in his last two fights by Walt Harris and Alistair Overeem. So the formula for beating Oleinik is to hit him in the head, and that's what Lewis does. Meanwhile, Lewis, with a lack of cardiovascular ability, as well, no ground skill whatsoever, has to keep this fight on the feet. Because if Oleinik can run around, take his back, or somehow drag the bigger man to the floor, Oleinik will submit Derek Lewis. And so we've watched this fight open Derek Lewis minus 280 to Oleinik minus 240, at least where I track my lines. And now if you look, that fight now has Lewis less than a 2-to-1 favorite. I think, quite honestly, that I've had enough of taking glass-jawed fighters that are old in fights. And if I were to bet this, it would have to be Lewis in this fight. And I would probably wait and continue to watch this line go down, because if Lewis gets to minus 175 or minus 180, I may have to get involved, because there will be abundant value on him, especially considering that opening 280.
You know, it's funny you talk about Oleinik sort of, you know, game plan. Yeah, when your name, when your nickname is the boa constrictor, you're not a knockout artist. You are a submission specialist. But, you know, sometimes we've talked about on the pod before is just in terms of avoiding laying the lumber with the juice. And in this case, the over-under is 1.5, not 2.5. And that's right in that sort of sweet spot. But I can't imagine Lewis is going to win past 1.5. Do you see an approach where it might make more sense to just go under 1.5 and avoid laying the juice?
That would be one way to do it. Or again, you might wait and take Lewis inside the distance as it, as the line continues to compress. You know, I do track other stats, and I track primarily heavyweight stats, but it's all in a 30-foot cage. And we need to remember that these two huge men, or at least Lewis, they're going to be in a much smaller, more confined area. It's going to encourage confrontation on both sides. It's going to be easier for Lewis to try and corner Oleinik, and it's also going to be easier for Lewis and Oleinik to begin doing a slow dance if Oleinik can get a hold of him. So every way you look at this fight, it's fascinating. And to which guy you want to go? Do you want to go the old, experienced, probably well more refined mixed martial artist in Oleinik, but he's got a fragile beak? Or do you go with the power slugger in Lewis? And right now, there's so many questions and unknowns in this fight. I'm really looking forward to watching it. But as I say, if this price on Lewis continues to drop, I'll have to get involved, just because the value will be too abundant to ignore.
Yeah, and something Matthew's talked about, just these main events have been going over because, you know, maybe guys are pacing themselves. They don't want to be, you know, ended too early. Now, granted, that a lot can change because of the smaller octagon that you alluded to. So it is a fascinating fight. And you're also intrigued by the co-main event.
Also intrigued by the co-main event because you have a fighter here, another Russian, a little bit different equipped. He's also a master of sport in sambo, also a Russian master of sport in hand-to-hand combat. Very well-rounded, but really a grappler. In his striking, he's effective, but he doesn't carry much power, and he really fights a lot to decision. He's strikes at a rate of 3 strikes per minute landed, and he accepts 2.8 strikes a minute. So that's a medium-paced guy, but he uses his striking to get in, to get a hold of people, and he averages 2.5 takedowns per 15 minutes. He wants to grapple. On the other side of the cage is Chris Weidman, ex-champion at 185, who's really undergone a tremendous career swoon since he lost his title to Luke Rockhold in December of 2015. Since that fight, he's fought 5 times. He's won 1 and lost 4, and the 4 losses, 3 of them were finishes. So actually, all of them were finishes. So he's running out of durability. His chin is questionable. And in this fight, he's coming off of a fight in his last one where he went up to 205 pounds. Now he's dropping back to 185. In previous fights, he's had hard times making the 185 cut. So it'll be really important Friday morning to make sure we watch how Weidman looks on the scales. If he looks shaky or really wan, that could be a tell for a bad cut, and maybe Akhmedov gets a little bit more of a lean. But when two world-class grapplers, and Weidman's a world-class wrestler, get in the octagon, Doug, a lot of times this turns into a stand-up fight. And if that's the case, and I think that's what the Weidman camp wants, Weidman, 2 inches taller, a 5-inch reach advantage arms, and a 2-inch reach advantage legs. Those are all tremendous advantages in a striking match. And he's the more effective, crisper striker than Akhmedov. So if this fight gets to be a roll in the hay, it's anyone's fight. But if Weidman can manage to keep it standing, I think he has an edge. But again, like Oleinik, I'm very hesitant to invest in older, washed fighters. If anything we've seen this year, Figueiredo against Joe B and other fights, is that the younger lions are coming and they're conquering the older lions, and the UFC is allowing some of these younger fighters to get their opportunity. I'm not necessarily saying that's the case here, but a lot of unknown with Weidman.
And that's the million-dollar question for the fight game in general, not just this matchup. But when a guy gets knocked out and he shows that weak jaw, it tends to snowball right away.
I couldn't agree more. That's well spoken, and that's the case with Weidman. You can fix poor conditioning, you can straighten your strikes, and you can be a more effective takedown artist, but you can't fix a chin as well. Going from 205 to 185, I think it's going to compromise him, and I think they feel good that Akhmedov doesn't have the power to touch Weidman, but I'm not so sure about that.
No, it's a fascinating just sort of handicap in the first two big fights, or I shouldn't say the first two, but the two big fights. Now, what else in the card? I talked to Matthew Holt. I'm like, you got anything you really like to share with our listeners, our loyal listeners? He's like, not really. I think Andrew Sanchez is a live dog, and that's basically all he had. So he didn't really love this card. I am going to play the main event. I just don't know. I think I'm going to do Lewis inside the distance, but you're right. I was impressed with Oleinik in his last fight, as you alluded to, but I'm fat. What else stands out to you, or maybe what do the analytics scream in this card?
Yeah. I just to touch on that main event, I think Oleinik's getting some recency bias too, with that looking so good against Verdum, and whatever the wave of betting is on him right now. Again, I would go ahead and wait Lewis inside the distance, or again, as you mentioned, the under 1.5 correlates to Lewis touching him early, which is exactly what his plan is. And if you like Oleinik, then you're going to lean to the over, because he has to just run in circles to get this fight into the third round and try and tire the man out. So going down, I'll highlight two underdogs that I like, and they're both on the main card, Doug. The next fight down is Darren Stewart against Mackie Patolo. Stewart, an Englishman, Patolo, a Hawaiian. The important thing to note in this fight is that Stewart's really a 185 middleweight fighter, and Patolo moved up to 185 from 170 in his last fight, where he looked very good and knocked his opponent out. Patolo's got really good power. He strikes at a high rate, 5.2 strikes landed per minute. He only accepts 3, so he's almost 2-1 in his output to what he accepts. Darren Stewart, 2.9 and 2.4, so a little bit more conservative striker. Stewart could choose to take this fight to the floor. Patolo only has a 33% takedown defense. And in my estimation, Patolo definitely wants to keep this fight standing. And we've watched fighters move up in weight. Gastelum, Robert Whitaker, Till, all of those guys, 85ers as well, that have really shown well after they move up. Patolo has good explosion. He's tough as he can be. Stewart lost his last fight in another organization, but he didn't look good against a fighter that wasn't very good. And so I've watched this line go from the opener, Darren Stewart -115. He's now -175 to -180. So someone likes his abilities, but I'm going to go the other way, and I'm going to be nice and quiet and allow these bettors to continue to bet Stewart, and let the dog price on Patolo rise. But I think he's live in this fight. And I don't think in a 3-round fight, I don't see anyone finishing it. If they did, it would be Pitolo. I think Pitolo can win a really strong decision here based on his cardiovascular striking, meaning that he'll still have ability to output high in the third round. And again, just like underdogs in any sport, Doug, and you understand this, it's best to be it's best to be patient and wait, because the favorites get bet, especially day of fight or day of event, and you might get another dime or so better price on Pitolo by waiting.
Well, and especially when there's a fight at a hotel, sportsbook, casino. Now, that's not the case this weekend, but that's something to always keep in mind. Usually the dog in the main event or a boxing match gets flooded with money because, as we've talked about on all sports, no one likes to risk a little to win a lot. Or excuse me, no one likes to risk a lot to win a little, so you always get the dog money, so the favorite becomes such value at usually the host venue. Now, with this card being in Las Vegas, at least, you might see some variance at some of the books, maybe the more public books that have more app reach, given what's going on this summer. So that's something to consider, and it all adds up, as we very well know. I asked you about what Reed does, and by the way, I should just kind of pay off what you were talking about with Reed. Obviously, he does a great job. For those who are unfamiliar, he has ESPN.com. He does picks every week. Really interesting follow on Twitter as well, so go check him out. It was sort of a layup softball question for Lou, because I had done a little bit of background on Reed, and obviously he's part of the ESPN family, so I wanted to, you know, do some homework there. But it is interesting with the analytics. Does anything stand out, like the analytics guys love this matchup because of X, Y, and Z?
No, you know, the analytics, there isn't much analytics. There's not many people doing, they do what I used to do, is they remember who they saw fight last, and then they bet it that way. Not that I'm the only one that goes through this monotony, but I believe what I do is you know, it sure helps me with my effectiveness. And a fight does stick out, and I'm going to give your listeners a bet that I want them to make, and I want them to make it now. I've made it now, and I've released it just this morning, so our timing is perfect, and it's also on the main card. You have a Beneil Dariush, an Iranian fighter, who is going to fight a guy named Scott Holtzman. This is going to be a fascinating fight. Dariush is going to be slightly taller. He's a left-hander, awkward striker. He's got a 3-inch reach advantage arms and a slight reach advantage, 1 inch with the legs. Dariush fought in his last fight a guy named Drakkar Klose, who trains or has trained extensively with Holtzman. Klose is a big, strong slugger that doesn't carry much power, and he's a little bit awkward. And in his fight with Dariush, Dariush was hurt by Klose. Klose got a little anxious and tried to rush in, and Dariush caught him. Dariush is the much more versed mixed martial artist in this fight, because he can strike. As awkward and looping and really non-precise as his striking is, he uses it as a way to get fights to the floor, where his grappling and his diverse ground attack takes over. In this fight, Dariush is going to find out really early that Holtzman, an ex-hockey player, can move, is much more the athletic man, is the straighter striker, is the cleaner, crisper, more precise striker with more power. And I think once Dariush feels that, he's going to want to take this fight to the floor. If this fight hits the floor, Dariush will hold advantage. However, Holtzman knows Dariush's propensity, and he's going to do everything he can to keep this thing standing. He has 80% takedown defense. He knows what Dariush wants to do. Dariush opened minus 170, and he sits about minus 170 or so now, meaning the take back on Holtzman is anywhere from plus 140 to plus 150. And that's a bet for me. Despite Holtzman not having the analytics on his side, I think that Dariush is really a good fight for Holtzman, and Holtzman's athleticism and striking will be the difference in this fight.
I knew it was going to be a dog as soon as you brought up the fight. So I was like, that's your style. You had the dog in the last week's main event, right? The big dog. So well done on that front.
Well, thank you. But in all due respect, I had two other dogs that looked so bad, I was embarrassed by them. But, you know, when you hit a 310 or a 330 underdog, it can make up for a lot of mistakes. And coming off that card, I was a little disappointed in my performance, even though we won great money based on that. I'm looking to put a few winners together this week, and Holtzman's my best bet for sure.
Okay, makes sense. As I've mentioned on the pod, I've talked to some odds makers. One really sharp guy is on Justin James, who's an underdog. Now, he grabbed him at plus 175. He's driven the market all the way down. The comeback's now plus 120 against Gavin Tucker. Do you have any feel for that one?
Yeah, that's one of the fights that I really like, but the one that I was going to kind of keep my cards to myself with, because I really like James myself. He's 1-0 in the UFC, took a short notice fight, and really looked good. Knocked out Frank Camacho, who's a tough guy, inside a few minutes. James fights this guy, Tucker, who has been really inactive. 3 fights in 3 years. He's a Canadian. And I just don't like fighters that haven't been active. And he took a complete beating a few fights back and incurred tremendous facial injuries after absorbing 142 strikes. So Tucker's kind of finding his way back into the organization. And James now, after a quick win, has momentum. He feels really good about himself. He's going to be the bigger man with some reach advantage. I really like James, but what I'm waiting for here is James's last few fights have been at 155, okay? This is a fight that's going to take place at 145. Tucker's a natural 145er, so I don't see him having an issue on the scale. But if James, kind of like Weidman, if James has trouble making 145 and he looks weak or feeble on the scale, I may back off of him. But my target is to bet James, provided he looks okay on the scale come Friday morning.
Okay, so James are passed for you. And, look, when we talk about all this kind of sharp stuff, or at least respected bets, it's important to realize that the bet was made at plus 175. It may not be as much of a bet at plus 120. When we talk about that with, especially during college football, when we see such movement in the lines, so always remember, they're on that side, but they were on that side +3.5. At 2.5, not so much. And that's obviously a big NFL number. I think it's around 18% of games every NFL season land 3. I don't know if it's land the favorite 3, but land 3. So probably less with the favorite 3. Anyways, I digress. Anything else stand out to you, Lou, before I let you go?
I just want to go ahead and comment on Matthew Holt's tip of Andrew Sanchez. That's also a fighter I'm looking at as well. I think he's ready for a little bit of a resurgence, and this is a good matchup for him. And you might also take a look at Means against Steropoli, the Italian. I think Means might be ready to fire as well. Other than that, I just want to thank you again, Doug, for allowing me to come in and share some thoughts, and good luck to everybody.
My pleasure. Yeah. So dogs on that one, Means plus 110 at last check. And as I mentioned earlier, Sanchez about a +130. So, my man, Lou, look, I hear you a lot. I've always been wanting to reach out and connect, and, no better time than the present to get those dots connected.
Thanks so much. And, again, good luck to everyone. And, Doug, I'll be in touch, and thank you for everything.
Kicking is for losers.
All right, a great debut for Lou. Good to have Wes back in the mix. Christina, good that you're hanging in there with the power outages. And I should mention, I'm out of power completely. So I've been using my Jetpack for Wi-Fi, my battery packs, for lack of a better, those little things you can kind of, you take the ball games and other stuff. So you need that extra juice and you're away from outlets for a while. So I've been charging those up at work, charging my laptops up at work, and then trying to survive with my Jetpack and using my Wi-Fi off Verizon. So a lot of moving parts, you make do, but I'm a little worried. Because my neighbor, Christina, said as many people are out of power now than there were during Hurricane Sandy.
Oh, no, that doesn't sound very good.
Yeah, no, the destruction's obviously not the same out here. But still, there's trees, there's road blockages. And we're still about 15 hours into this. So still not 24 hours. But I am hearing it could be a couple days, if not longer. So I'm hopeful, but not optimistic, if that makes any sense. So until then, we have to download the podcast. No TV, but you got the podcast here. So hopefully we have some winners in here, and we'll catch you back here next week.